Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Right now I'm finishing the last-minute editing of an article of mine that will come out in an international journal issue on children and psychiatry. When it's published, I'll alert all of you to it. I'm coming to the conclusion in this article that it's time to take a completely principled stand and call for a stoppage, a ban on giving psychoactive chemicals to children for the control of their emotions or behavior, or for the treatment of psychiatric disorders. Medications that are non-psychiatric are of use. They may have psychoactive effects. For example, you can treat seizures with a drug that will also have psychoactive effects. You can treat physical pain with drugs that will also have more general psychoactive effects. Those are legitimate uses, but they too need to be done with caution. On the other hand, the drugs that are specifically aimed at modifying the behavior, emotions, or alleged psychiatric disorders of children, I believe would have no place in a sane society. Now, this is way ahead of its time. I'm not expecting in my lifetime to see a ban on giving psychoactive substances to children for these purposes, but I do think it's important to establish the principle and to begin working toward it. This distinction between a psychiatric drug and a medical drug is very similar to a distinction I made back in the early 1970s. When I ran a successful international campaign to stop the return of phlebotomy and other forms of psychosurgery. I made a distinction then between genuine neuroscience and genuine neurosurgery, which can treat seizures or a tumor or other problems in the brain, and psychosurgery, or psychiatric surgery as it was sometimes called, which treats emotions, conduct, behavior, and psychiatric diagnoses. And that was a successful distinction that I made when I testified in the Kamowitz case, which contributed to stopping psychosurgery in all kinds of facilities in the U.S., the VA, state hospitals, NIH. The Kamowitz decision judges used that distinction that I made between genuine neurosurgery and psychosurgery. And so I want to begin this show in advance of the article, which will be out in a few months, saying it really is time to call for a ban. Now, I don't know what my guest thinks about this, and I won't ask him to comment on it unless he feels like it, but it's a very appropriate subject. My guest is a man for whom I have a great deal of respect. He's Dr. Dathan A. Paterno, and it's Dathan with a D. Paterno, P-A-T-E-R-N-O. Dathan is a licensed clinical psychologist. He's been working with children and adolescents for nearly 20 years. He's currently the director of the Park Ridge Psychological Services. It's in the Chicago area. It's a private practice, and it serves children, adolescents, and their families from what he calls a holistic perspective. I want to learn more about that. He believes, as I do, that parents best serve their kids when they establish an appropriate hierarchy, a system in which we parents are morally in charge and by holding the kids to very high standards. And like me, he's against the notion that, kids behave badly due to psychiatric disorders like ADHD or bipolar disorder. He's the author of two interesting books. One is Desperately Seeking Parents, Why Your Child Needs a Parent in Charge and How to Become One. It's a good book. And now, very interestingly, he's co-authored a book called Ladies and Gentlemen. It's about civility in our society, its loss and regaining it. I like these ideas. My daughter, Allie, communicates occasionally with Dathan Paterno about raising kids. Allie's the best mom I know, and I take it as a tribute to Nathan Paterno that she, from Dathan Paterno, that she gets something useful from talking with him, or at least communicating by email. Dathan, are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I really looked forward to this. Where would you like to begin talking about? First of all, is your practice in Chicago or is it on the outskirts?
It's on the outskirts. It's pretty close to O'Hare, so it's just 5 minutes away from Chicago.
And how do people get in touch with you?
They can go to my website, which is www.prpsych.com. Or they can just look me up on Amazon.com for my books, and it also has my contact information there.
That's great. Where would you like to begin?
Well, I loved your introduction about banning psychoactive drugs for children. And I, too, hope that in the coming decades that we can move toward that. My personal view is very similar to yours, that it's almost never, and I only use that qualifier because I hate to be so black and white, but I can't think of any case with a child where psychiatric drugs was beneficial or the preferred method. And so I think that ultimately I think we need to ban it, whether the government should do that or parents just need to unite and clinicians need to unite and recognize that we collectively should be banning this practice is a good debate. But I think ultimately I would like to see children not go through life with their brains bathed in psychiatric drugs. My personal practice is to try to make it irrelevant and try to make other choices much more attractive and successful and safe so that parents and other clinicians can look at a more holistic model and say, well, we don't need psychiatric drugs because these other methods are working so much better without any untoward effects.
Now, in my work, I don't tend to use the term holistic because it has connotations of lots of alternative healthcare stuff, some of which I think is useful and some not. What do you mean by a holistic perspective?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question because I know it's a treacherous word. It can be misunderstood.
I find it a little so, but not
It's a better word than what we heard in graduate school. A lot of psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers heard the biopsychosocial model, and that one kind of doesn't really sit well in my gut. So the word holistic to me just really means that we approach problems and people from multiple perspectives, including diet, sleep, and exercise, as well as any drugs or alcohol or any other kind of environmental toxins. Okay, I always look at that initially when a child comes in with some kind of emotional or behavior problem because I see that children aren't sleeping well, they're not getting enough exercise, their diets are poor, or they're taking drugs and the parents don't know that it's negatively affecting them or contributing to or worsening whatever kind of problems are currently going on. And so that's the physiological or the kind of triad of diet, sleep, and exercise that I pay attention to. And then we pay attention to relational factors. And then we pay attention to educational and socioeconomic factors and spiritual factors. And essentially, holistic means that we look at every layer of functioning in the child and in every area of context in the child's life. That's really what I mean by holistic.
One of the things that I find that I love in my practice is, and this is just in the last week, two examples come to my mind, where a family has a child that they have some conflict with, and the child could be 6 to 30, I guess, whatever, 6 to whatever, especially if they're dependent and living at home. And the parents feel like the child will never talk and won't work out issues, and the child comes in with them, and within minutes we have a very good and even loving conversation going about the misunderstandings and upsets in the family. And it is so healing. Yet colleagues, our colleagues, yours in psychology, mine in psychiatry, the whole bunch of them in mental health, tend to treat the child in isolation, diagnose them, give them a drug, when it's really always a family approach, I think, that's best. And I'm sure you're on that same wavelength with me.
Oh, yes, definitely. It's a really a joy. I know you know what I'm talking about when you do the discovery process, when you first meet somebody and you can see that they come in distress, the family's in distress, the parents are in distress, and the child sometimes is in distress and sometimes is not. But there is clearly a problem going on, and the parents have an initial hypothesis of what's going on with the child, whether it's because of their own guesses or they've been listening to mainstream psychiatry or their pediatrician has told them that their child might have some kind of disorder or disability or disease. And so they come in with these ideas, and it doesn't take very long to discover that there is a good reason for why the child is struggling or why the parents are struggling with the child. And usually it's a common sense discovery. And once we bring that to the fore with the parents, there is so often a sense of such great relief and joy. And then we instill hope because we understand that the child is really normal, that the child is really just dealing with some abnormal circumstances, or the school or the parents or whomever it is not a good fit in the child's life, and so that's creating some upset. And it really is such a joy to be able to, you know, collaboratively discover that with the parents and then, you know, work, you know, usually pretty quickly toward a pretty good solution.
Well, just talk some more about your practice, about the kinds of kids you work with, the kinds of families you work with. Are they mostly fairly well-off families? Do you get to see poor families? Just in general, Tell us about your work.
Sure. Well, our practice really is pretty new. I only started it about 5.5 years ago. I had done an internship at a center, another private practice, whose focus was ADHD and bipolar disorder. And I really loved the people there, but I knew pretty quickly that it wasn't going to be a permanent professional fit. So I knew that I needed to strike out on my own. And I know you can relate to this a little bit, being a maverick in the field. I feel like I go against the grain in terms of my own profession. So I knew I needed to do it my own way. So I struck out on my own about 5 years ago, and within about 3 years, tripled in size. And in the last 2 or 3 years, we've now tripled again, and so we have 9 clinicians working here with a pretty similar background and a pretty similar philosophy. And our practice, and I hate to use the word treat, but we work with children and adolescents and adults, particularly families. That's really our emphasis here. But we see a pretty broad range. Our practice is big enough that we can have interns and practicum students, and a lot of them have some, you know, connections where we can, you know, see poor and minority groups, people who are underserved populations, for next to nothing or you know, free, which is really a privilege. One of the other things that we do is we see veterans here for low cost or no cost, outside of a medical model, and it's really been a privilege to do that.
Dathan, this is very, very exciting. I'm just learning about what you're doing at your clinic, and what a marvel that you're bringing this model to treating numbers of people, to giving an umbrella to other professionals to work under. And are you actually getting interns from universities?
Yeah, from Adler and a couple other schools. We actually have somebody from Northwestern University here as well. And it's really a privilege to see how some of them come from the universities where they're being inculcated with the medical model. And when we interview them and tell them a little bit about what they do, their eyes just light up as if
yes.
they've never heard this before. They want to check it out and see if this is actually possible. You know, they look at you like they're really men on Mars, and we can prove to them that you can heal without psychiatric drugs. You can get better by actually doing family work. You can be in control of a family without being controlling. And it's really a marvel to see them open up to it.
You know, even older professors, I gave a talk, a series of talks at one of the most established PsyD's programs, psychology programs in the country. And afterward was having lunch with folks, and one of the most prestigious professors there got tears in his eyes and told me that I reminded him why he originally went into the profession and how lost the profession was getting. And he literally had tears in his eyes. People are hungering on a professional and a personal level for a more caring, psychological, social approach to helping them. I think it's marvelous. Now, you mentioned Adler. Is that an Adlerian school? Or just
yes.
That happened to be the name?
No, it's an Adlerian school.
I love Adlerians. I feel like I've been recently rereading a lot of Adler because I'm co-authoring a book. We haven't got it out yet or, you know, gotten the publisher yet. We're just working on writing it now with an Adlerian friend of mine on raising kids. It's going to be about not drugging them and giving them a good approach. And reading Adler over again, I realized how profoundly he influenced me in my thinking, that a lot of ideas that I thought that I either got out of the atmosphere or somehow stumbled on, he was actually talking about, and I was actually reading back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And I'll be down in Florida in Tampa the last week of February and the first day of March, first 2 days of March, doing, at an Adlerian conference in Tampa, the Florida Adlerians. People can Google it. Have you been influenced by Adler, or do you just like working with him?
Well, I do, because I agree with Adler that children are goal-oriented, and it's not so mechanistic, and I think the heart of psychology and psychiatry needs to move back to that. You know, we make our own choices, and I also like the idea of the inferiority complex and the idea that, you know, children often don't feel like they're valuable unless they're the center of attention. And a lot of I know you've talked about this, how ADD and ADHD aren't really an inability of the child to pay attention, but it's much more of a poverty of attention that is paid to them appropriately, and that children act out oftentimes because of that. And I think Adler would probably say something similar about ADHD.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he would. And one of the things he said that I love, picking up on themes we've been talking about, he said that he never met a child that he couldn't have a meaningful conversation with.
Right.
Boy,
right.
We don't know that anymore in mental health, do we?
Right, and that's such a profound lesson that I've been learning in my practice. I'm fairly young, and I've been working with children for about 22 years now, but I'm learning constantly about not just the universals of human behavior and the human soul, but how complex and unique all of us really are, and walking that balance of the universal and uniqueness is really a privilege to learn about and a joy to experience.
It's astonishing, Dathan, how similar you and I feel about so many things. Did you ever read my work along the way? I don't know.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's not a secret that when I started graduate school, I had a professor who introduced me to the work of Bert Caron, whom you know, obviously, is a patron saint of our line of work. And in his book, he mentions your work. And my professor said, "Oh yeah, if you want to read, you know, somebody really good on you know, the conscience of psychiatry," I can't remember the phrase that she used, "read Toxic Psychiatry." And so I read Toxic Psychiatry, kind of being still in the outskirts of the mainstream view, and it was a watershed event. Me reading that book. I remember I was just newly married at that time, and my wife recalls how I was just walking around with the book in my hand saying, "Can you believe this?" Things like that over and over again, and it produced really a radical change in my viewpoint.
Oh, Lord, I don't think I knew that. I don't know if you ever told me that, and I just have had a little trouble hearing it sometimes.
Well, but I think it's a pretty common event. I mean, you probably hear that so often that
I do hear
it. Just another person.
Yeah. That's wonderful, though. That's absolutely wonderful. Tell me some more about this practice, because I think it's really important for people to know that these things can be set up. Now, do you own this practice? How does it work?
Yes. Like I said, I started about 5.5 years ago, and I have a partner now, co-clinical director Jessica Fox, who is just a phenomenal LCPC. She does great work with adolescents. We call her the adolescent girl whisperer here because she does such great work with young women who are struggling kind of under the radar. And I think we find that that's been a really difficult population to deal with, and she just does marvelous work with them. And my specialty, I certainly wouldn't call myself an expert yet, but my specialty is working with young children who have behavior and emotional kind of regulation problems, so to speak, kids who would otherwise be diagnosed with ADHD or who have already been diagnosed with ADHD. And I do a lot of work diagnosing the problem, and 9 times out of 10, it's a familial problem. Sometimes it's simply a problem of diet, sleep, and exercise or something like that, or it's a kid who's being bullied and things like that. But I've never, ever diagnosed a child with ADHD. You know, people come and they say, "Hey, can you do an ADD evaluation on me?" And I'll say, "I'll do one, but I know what the result is going to be already. If you want me to go through the formality, I'd be happy to do that." And a lot of times parents will say, "No, thank you. I want to go somewhere where I can get a label." And I respect that. I understand that they're going to do that. But so many parents are very, very pleased when they realize that, no, their child is not abnormal. They don't have broken brains. They have broken relationships, broken ideas, broken families, broken thoughts, and this can be corrected. So I work primarily with parents to fix some of these problems. And what, again, my first book, Desperately Seeking Parents, the model that I use is that parents really need to claim reasonable control in their household. And when I say that, I know that the word control has a bad connotation for a lot of people, but what I mean is not that we need to be controlling as parents. We need to be in control, to be a container for a child's behavior and have good boundaries with them and to be able to hold on to their feelings and be really just a good sounding board for them and to stop them from making choices that would hurt them. And I think one of the things that I espouse very strongly is that children need to be trained. Just like we need to be trained to read and trained to do sports and trained to be psychiatrists, children need to be trained to have self-control. You know, the executive functions, particularly, that are implicated in the diagnosis of ADHD, those are skills that can be and must be trained. And many of the children that I see just haven't been trained either sufficiently or correctly according to the child's unique temperament. And when I can help a parent know how to train them properly and to let them know that those skills are amenable to training, they can make some significant headway in a very short span of time.
I'm glad you used that term, executive functioning. I was thinking of it myself earlier in the show because it's one of those things that parents are sold, that their kids have, quote, executive functioning problems, that they're somehow not able to be in charge of their own brains, and also implies an underlying physical disorder in the frontal lobes. And in fact, what those kids need is some help, training as you put it, some help and direction in managing their lives. It is really the big gift that we have to give our children is taking responsibility for their lives. It's the big deal of growing up, learning to take charge of your life and make it into something good and worthwhile. And when you tell a child they have ADHD or any psychiatric, psychological diagnosis, right away the kid begins to think, well, I'm not in charge. Something else is. Something else has got a hold of me, and I don't. And it's a disaster for the child, for the teachers, for the parents, all of whom view the kid as not responding to normal education and parenting. But again, it's astonishing. You and I have not had a lot of conversation together. It's astonishing how similar our views are. Just keep talking, Nathan Paterno. We got 5 minutes to break.
Okay. I'll talk about my book a little bit and how I noticed over my first several years in practice that when I trained the parents to train the children, that very quickly the children's behavior would improve. And it was just very exciting to see. And so I wrote the book with the notion that parents need to see their children as normal, functioning human beings with the same potential as anybody else. I have a whole section in there about diseases, disorders, and disabilities, and how we too often place the blame on the child or the child's brain, when in fact I think that's a defense mechanism for parents who are living harried lifestyles, whose marriages are not very good, who are forced because of economic distress to work too much just to survive, and they're not giving their children what the children need. And one of the other things, I think, and this is not a blame game, you know, whenever I bring up the idea that it's the parents' responsibility, immediately many parents and other professionals will say, you're blaming the parents. Well, okay, maybe I am blaming the parents, and sometimes parents are guilty as charged. But look, I come from the perspective that all parents are imperfect, because all people are imperfect. And so if I can be empathic and compassionate with parents and recognize that we're all deeply imperfect and that in our imperfections there will be negative consequences, but if I'm powerful enough that my negative or bad choices or imperfections can harm somebody, then we also have the self-agency and the power to fix it. And so I like to put my energy not into blaming or pinpointing, you know, whose fault it is, but saying that you have the power to alter your child's life. You are the primary agent of change in your child's life. I don't want to be the primary agent of change. I don't want the pediatrician or the psychiatrist or the drug or the teacher to be the primary agent of change. I want you to be the primary agent of change, and you will feel empowered by that. And when you feel empowered by that, the child will pick up on that, and they will get such a sense of safety and love from that. Ah, I know that my mom and dad are in charge. They know what they're doing. They love me. They put limits on me. They correct me. And they give me all the love and affection that I need. And they won't let me step outside of what I intuit as healthy behavior. And children just love that.
You know, every animal trainer knows this. Every dog trainer knows this. And not to diminish children, the same thing is true, that people who are growing up and haven't developed control over their lives, that is children, feel a lot more secure and a lot happier when the adults are in charge. We have a new little Shetland sheepdog named Sherry, sometimes Sherry Berry, sometimes Sherry Snickerdoodle. She's a little tiny girl. And she's so much more peaceful when she knows that we're in charge in a loving but definitive way. And it's the same with children. And it's such a shame that so few in the field of mental health are really looking at this and examining this. We've got about a minute or so before break. Are you noticing a change in the profession? I'm seeing some positive changes going on out there.
I think so. I think there's a lot of fear out there that if psychologists and other mental health professionals give up the mainstream view, that somehow there's going to be some kind of economic punishment, that they won't be able to bill insurance or get paid or be on panels, or, you know, the government's going to come in and say, here's the standard of care. You have to drug certain behaviors and you have to medicate for certain diagnoses. And I think some people are afraid. But at the same time, I see a little bit of what you're seeing, that people's eyes are being opened a little bit, at least to the limits of the efficacy and safety of psychiatric drugs.
Oh, I think that your clinic, for example, is just an outstanding example of what can be done now. As we go to break, we're talking with Dathan Paterno, P-A-T-E-R-N-O. He's a psychologist just outside of Chicago and a therapist who runs a clinic where you can actually get the kind of services you need. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and my guest, Dathan Paterno. His book on child rearing called Desperately Seeking Parents, Why Your Child Needs a Parent in Charge and How to Become One. There's lots more to talk about, but I really want to jump ahead to his newest book. It's called Ladies and Gentlemen. Tell us about that.
About 5 years ago, I took my son, who was just a few years old at that time. We went to a mall, and I remember walking with him and showed him how to open the door for a lady. And I remember opening the door, and the woman walked right past me without saying a word. And I wasn't terribly insulted or anything like that, but I remember thinking to myself, you know, I remember when I was a child, I was taught to do this, and it was pretty standard that a man would open a door for a woman, and the woman would say thank you. And it got me thinking about the terms lady and gentleman. And civility, and in combination with what I see on TV, particularly cable news programs where people are yelling at each other, and when you look at politics, you see everybody yelling at each other, and there isn't much civility there. And so it got me thinking about the terms ladies and gentlemen, and where did they come from, and why aren't we using them anymore? I mean, the only time you hear the term lady is when you have a magician say, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to such and such, or the performer Lady Gaga. And the only time you hear the term gentleman is when you hear about a gentleman's club, which is not really a place where you would expect to see civility. And so I really wanted to do a study of the term and think a little bit about why we've lost those virtues and those ideals. And is it possible for us in our culture to move back to those ideals? And what's it really going to take? So I hunted down somebody to write it with me. I figured as a man, I needed a female partner to do this. So I found somebody who I thought would have similar views to me. And so I found Dr. Gina Loudon. She's a frequent guest on Fox News and things like that. She's a wonderful radio host. And she agreed to write the book with me. She has some similar views. And so we set out to do a history of the terms. And then the argument is that in the last century or so, we've lost the ideals and the virtues inherent in those terms. And then we set aside some time to talk about what we think needs to happen in our culture to reclaim the ideas and the ideals.
It fits closely with your ideas on child rearing.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think that, again, it has a lot to do with training. One of the chapters that we have in our book is the quintessential gentleman, and the next chapter, of course, is the quintessential lady. And we chose George Washington and Abigail Adams as our quintessential lady and our quintessential gentleman. And one of the things that came through in my individual studies on George Washington is how important training was, how his family trained him to be a gentleman. And that didn't just mean how to mix, a cocktail or how to tie a bow tie. It wasn't just about how to speak or how to open a door. It was so much more about virtue and self-control and humility and all of those other things. It wasn't just the superficial things. It was the deep characterological traits that made him such a profound hero in our culture and in our country's history. And yes, and it really made me hungry to train my own children that way. I have two daughters and a son, and it really honed my training and my awareness of what my son needs to be trained up in order to become not just an upstanding, but an outstanding citizen.
Do you run into flack from your colleagues from the idea that this is a throwback, that you're not appreciating the feminist issues and stuff like that? Quite what words to use.
Yeah, I mean, we ultimately suggest that that radical feminism is partly to blame for this. Now, there's a good feminism. There's classical feminism. And, Dr. Gina Loudon, and I would suggest that Abigail Adams herself was a feminist. I can think par excellence she was a feminist. I mean, if you read some of the letters between her and her husband, you will see that Abigail Adams was no, shrinking wallflower. She was a very strong woman and wanted women's rights attended to from the very beginning.
Yeah, she wrote him that that the Congress ought to pay more attention to women since they were the ones bearing the brunt of the war at home, as she was.
Yeah.
And she was also even a more outspoken opponent of slavery than her husband was, from my understanding.
Yes, a lot of the women in the abolition movement back then were women, and they obviously they could push that a little bit harder, and they were often the impetus for the men to do that, which is often the case for things, isn't it? That we're really the ones out in front, and the women are pushing us. At least that's what it was for John Adams. But yeah, she was a very strong woman, and we have a lot of respect for classical feminism. But one of our arguments is that in the last 100 years or so, the radical feminist movement has devalued the masculine, has devalued and ignored the complementary nature of men and women. The famous saying, woman needs a man like fish needs a bicycle. That kind of a thing, I think, really devalues men. And I think when men feel devalued or if they're not needed, what are they going to do? I think it creates an existential problem for men, which I think is deeply related to the high divorce rate and the difficulty in families today. Men and women are not deeply respecting each other, particularly in their complementary roles. And I think when that happens, it really oftentimes results in not just a lot of discord, but a lot of the dissolution of marriage, which, of course, then is terrible for children.
This is all really, really, really interesting. Do you get into writing at all more about this? Or are you going to get you're feeling that maybe you've gone far enough? Because this gets you into the political. And I know when I write about the political, I feel it gets sometimes in the way of my reform work, I like to draw from across this political spectrum. But maybe that's too much of an issue for the radio as well.
That's a great question, because I feel myself pulled in several directions. One is the political, where does this fit in a political struggle? Two, the reform work, but I can, like I tell people in my individual practice, I work with children, adolescents, and adults. I tell people, children might be my wheelhouse. That might be my area of specialty, but I can only play so much Candyland. I need to do other things to keep me fresh and interested and engaged. So yeah, I dabble in the politics, I dabble in the cultural, and I feel very strongly about parenting. I think my next book is going to be another parenting book. Right now the working title is How to Build a Healthy Child, and it's going to be, the 20 or so things, the essential needs that children have in order to grow up healthy and reasonably self-controlled.
let me focus again back on the practice. I'm really interested in part the correspondence of our views. So I have a couple of questions about how you do things. In the practice, do you ever work with children without their families, little children, say 5, 6 up to pre-adolescent kids, and establish relationships with them as a counselor? I generally tend to do it within the family. And similarly to that, do you have any play therapists who tend to emphasize the therapist, again, working with the child rather than working with the family?
Yes, I mean, the answer is both. When I meet with a parent first, and whenever I have a new child as a client, and I call them clients, not patients, I think the semantics are really important for me as a psychologist. But when I meet with the parents, I want to get an assessment of where does the problem lie. If there's really a problem with the children's thought processes or the child's reasoning skills, something like that, then I think more direct work with the child is really important. Or if a child has some deep existential issues that he or she is not able to voice, we sometimes neglect existential issues with children because they often can't voice it. And yet children oftentimes are deeply ensconced in an existential crisis. And it really takes some skill to try to draw that out of them in a way that allows them to express themselves. Particularly when there's grief and loss, most 5-year-old boys can't say, I'm really, really sad, and this makes me doubt God's existence, and I don't know what to do with that because I don't know what happens when I die. I don't know many 5-year-olds who are able to do that. Yet those feelings and those thoughts are swirling around in their conscious or subconscious, and we have to draw that out of them in a safe enough environment that we can resolve some of those things, or at least let the parents know that that's going on with the child. And so, yes, sometimes I do work with the child alone, but the vast majority of times, that's usually in addition to working with the family. And then when it comes to play therapy, I do a little bit of play therapy. I don't consider myself a play therapist, but we do have two other PsyDs here who are play therapists. And we have a room dedicated to play therapy where we have the dollhouse and we have the puppets and we have, the sand table and all of that kind of stuff where kids can, really just have a great time and a lot of stuff comes out. And particularly when there's trauma in their history that's suspected, that's usually a pretty good bet. But I think the important thing with working with younger children is that the child has to, number one, feel safe. And number two, has to feel that you like them. Children want to know that you like them, and then they will warm up to you. And so not just your demeanor, but what you do with the child is so important. So when I meet a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old, I don't have them sit on the couch and expect to have a 45-minute conversation with them. Most children wouldn't feel respected in the way that they know that they relate. And so I try to get on their level and play on the floor with them and color and make stories and, beat them in checkers and things like that. And when we do that, the child feels really engaged, and then they can open up and feel safe.
Do you do this with the parents in the room, showing them how to play, or do you do it sometimes alone?
Sometimes alone, particularly when I'm just developing a relationship. Sometimes when a parent brings the child in for the initial consultation, I will play with them on the floor while I'm talking to the parent. And I try in both my peripheral vision and in the nonverbals that I see how the parent is watching me relate to their child. Because sometimes I get this sense of bewilderment with a parent that, wow, he's on the floor and he's playing and he doesn't mind getting dirty, or, he doesn't mind that his hair is ruffled up, or he's roughhousing a little bit with the child. Because some kids, particularly younger kids, they want to come in and they want to roughhouse. And it brings up some really interesting, the issues of countertransference and transference, where children need that kind of engagement, particularly boys. And if I know that there's a single mom in the office, it's so important that the mom see that it's okay to be physical with a kid. And that's actually something that I think a lot of therapists are deathly afraid of. I don't know if you talk to other therapists about that, but they're so scared to touch the child, you know, to give them high fives and even a hug, or swing them around a little bit, or run up and down the hall with them, and, you know, things like that. I think it's so important. Actually, that's one of the chapters of my new book that I'm working on, is going to be a whole chapter dedicated on how it's important to roughhouse with children, of course, in a safe way. But it's such a wonderful experience, and it bonds, and it also establishes a hierarchy. So there are a lot of things that happen in the therapy room that are kind of you wouldn't necessarily predict would happen in a therapist room, but is absolutely critical to developing a good relationship. So sometimes the parent's just watching, and sometimes I'm alone with the child, and sometimes I actually teach the parent how to relate to the child.
It sounds like very, very good work. One of the things I've noticed is that my way of relating to people changes as I've grown older, and the way people relate to me has changed as I grow older. And I'm noticing that my work with children goes better now than it used to, because I think they're skipping all the travail of relating to me like a parent, and they're jumping to relating to me as a grandpa.
Yeah.
And like a grandpa, I have this huge charisma that lasts, even if I only happen to see the kids once a month while I'm working with their parents more often. Kids just need that hierarchy, and I think I hadn't thought of it exactly that way till you would speaking, that it's a part of the hierarchy that their mom and dad come to see the grandfather, in effect, and they're benefiting, and the kids are benefiting, and the kids love grandpa, even though they may not get to see him so much, and they really care about what he thinks, and they carry him in his heart. And I experienced that with the kids. I had a youngster, a preteen who was behaving very disrespectfully toward me, under a lot of stress, and I told him I was just impossible to relate to him, and he was being that way, and we didn't get much further than that. And then on the way home, he gets on the cell phone and he calls me and tells me he's sorry and he loves me. And that's so good for him, and it's good for me, of course, too. But it's so
good.
And
it gives you an opportunity for that, what we call in our profession, the corrective emotional experience, where he tries to dominate you or doesn't want to have anything to do with you, and then he inadvertently sees that you can be gracious with him, and that when he reapproaches you, that grace is the primary thing there, and that then he can trust you, because now he knows that he doesn't have to be perfect. And when we recognize that we don't have to be perfect in a relationship, we're much freer. That doesn't mean that we have a license to do whatever we want, but it means that we don't have the pressure of fear of stepping across a line which will just ultimately disintegrate a relationship. And that's been a lot of children's experience, particularly children whose parents have divorced. They are deathly afraid of relationship disintegrating and ending. And there's a lot of unconscious anxiety that happens from that. And so kids, when they realize that, oop, they've stepped across a line, they make it even more stark in order to control that. And we have to prove to them that I'm different. I'm not going to reject you permanently or radically if you make an error. And especially if you apologize, you're right back in, and we can be friends again.
You're very articulate, Dathan Paterno. Do you do workshops for people? You'd be really good at that.
You know, I actually do some workshops for parenting. I have, I have my PowerPoint and all that kind of stuff. And I use my book. And everybody wants to talk about, the 1,000 different ways to do timeout, and how do I do timeout, and is spanking appropriate, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I do workshops, particularly about parenting. And it's really fun. I have a great time doing it. I haven't done a lot of workshops about other things, but parenting is definitely in my wheelhouse. Yes.
Well, I'm really, really glad to hear that. I hope down the road that maybe you'll be able to get to one of our empathic therapy conferences and do a workshop on parenting. I think it would be very valuable to people. Well, tell me some more about your practice. What are your long-term goals? What do you see yourself doing? Where do you see the profession going? I think you have a lot of insight.
Well, one of my sub-passions is equipping churches and synagogues to do the work that we do. I'm not against my profession. I don't want to destroy it by any means. But I want the community to be doing the work of empathy and compassion and teaching and training. And, you know, one of the most important words in our profession is normalizing. I want the churches and synagogues to be doing that work. I think because they're often, other than the schools and the pediatrician's office, those are the front lines. You know, how many parents or people struggling with problems in their children go to their pastors and their rabbis and say, what do I do? And a lot of times the pastors will just immediately refer them to a professional. And while that keeps me very busy, I'd like to work myself out of a job at a certain point. And I want the community to be doing that. I want there to be committees at churches and synagogues and in the public community where we can help people with those problems without having to go to a professional per se. And one of the reasons for that is because I think that churches and synagogues believe that there is a higher purpose. And that there is a natural hierarchy in the world. And I think it goes in line with my work really nicely. But secondly, I think that ultimately people need to hear that anybody can help them. Okay? I don't have any particular expertise or skill. You know, I mean, it's almost a dirty secret in my profession. Yeah, I might know a few theories and things like that, but really what it boils down to is my philosophy, my beliefs about human beings, and my ability to relate to people. And hopefully that I'm both knowledgeable enough and humble enough to stick with people until we discover the problems and the true root of the problems. And I don't really think that a lot of people couldn't do what I do, frankly. I don't mean to undermine what I do. I think I work very hard and I think I'm pretty good at it, but I think a lot of people could do this. And then lastly, I think in our culture, we have too much of an emphasis on experts. You know, something's going wrong here, you go to an expert. Something's going wrong there, you go to another expert. And I don't think that's really healthy. I'd like to see the family and the community take care of more of our problems, our everyday problems, so that we're not farming it out to others.
Well, you've just described two or three of my most unfulfilled ambitions. I'm so much on the same wavelength as you. I have talked to directors of PsyD schools about involving churches and synagogues, teaching ministers and priests and rabbis that they, with good hearts and good training, could be handling problems instead of sending folks off to psychiatrists for drugs. I've also believed deeply that we could train people to do good therapy with a year of supervision. 1 year total training if we just chose them not at all on their education and background, but completely on whether they were responsible and empathic human beings, that many grandparents would be marvelous at that, and many other people as well who had some experience in life. I'm just in agreement with you on so many issues. It's stunning in a way. But I haven't had much success. I've spent quite a bit of time at a PsyD school recently, talking with the upper echelons about this, and they found it interesting, but didn't get a lot of places with it. I want to thank you for being on the show. The music has started. I've been talking with Dathan Paterno. He's a clinical psychologist. He's in the Chicago area. His book is Desperately Seeking Parents.